This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Have you ever been in the zone? You know, that psychological state athletes sometimes report where everything seemed completely in sync. Every action was effortless, every right next step came so easily, and most likely you completely lost track of time. Psychologists call this state flow. Is this something you recognize? Something that pops up frequently in your life? Or, if you're more like me, is it something you think you experienced once or twice and sure wish you could get back to? If that's the case, it's just possible today's guest can make wishes come true. Psychologist Brody Gregory has been studying flow and other aspects of peak performance for many years now. Recently, she's taking up teaching others about it. And now she's agreed to help us with some performance enhancement lessons right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. What's your idea of a state of peak performance? When did you last experience such a thing? How'd you manage to get there? Is this something important in your life, something you'd like to be able to do more often for longer periods of time? Our guest is a research psychologist who has been studying motivation and leadership in academic, athletic, and business settings, and she's taken a special interest in the being in the zone state that psychologists refer to as flow. So we'll be talking to her about all of that in the hour ahead. But please know that you will not be interrupting our flow if you decide to join in. Your questions and comments, most welcome at 888-WMRA-TALK, which translates to 888-967-2825. She is a former manager of leadership development at the international consumer goods firm Procter & Gamble. Today, she serves as visiting faculty in the psychology department at Washington and Lee University. Dr. Brody Gregory, welcome back to the Insight Studio. So good to see you again.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back.
So, Brody, can you explain flow to me?
I can do my best to explain flow. It is such an abstract concept. It's hard to do it justice with words. In general, the psychological state of flow is when you are totally absorbed in whatever it is that you are doing. Many people describe it as being in the zone. People tend to lose a sense of time and awareness of both themselves and their surroundings. If you experience flow, you might all of a sudden realize that 5 hours have passed and you're not quite sure what you've been doing, but you feel great about it.
So it sounds like it's almost always a positive experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say generally it is pretty positive. One of the hallmarks of experiencing flow is that you lose a sense of self-awareness and self-focus, and you're just fully absorbed in whatever the task is. And presumably, it would be difficult to achieve that state if you were doing something that you didn't really care about or was not very enjoyable.
So our first question just coming on Facebook, and Christine, who wrote this, is responding to the question we posted on Facebook that said, have you ever been in the psychological state known as flow? And Christine says, yes, when I was gardening once and went right through lunch till the school bus pulled up. I don't know what this means.
Mother-in-law.
Oh, my mother-in-law. Oh, see? Okay.
I saw that earlier and thought about it for a while.
My mother-in-law laughed and said she could never miss a meal. Also experienced it while writing. That's the best. Time stands still.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we could have paid her to say what she said. She pretty much sums up what most people say when they experience a state of flow. So you don't attend to basic bodily needs sometimes when you're in a state of flow. You might work right through lunch or right through dinner, and you don't even realize that you're hungry until all of a sudden you kind of come out of the zone and realize it's been, 5 or 6 hours since you've eaten something.
So, okay, research psychologist Dr. Brody Gregory, what have you discovered about what causes this state, mm-hmm. how people get into it, how somebody who wants to get into it more often can set up conditions to encourage it happening?
That's a great question, and there are a lot.
Actually, it was three.
A great array of questions. There are some really important conditions for people to be able to experience flow. One is that you can experience flow in any type of activity, and I think Christine's comment is a great illustration of that. So often, people tend to think about flow or being in the zone as applying only to things like sports, But you can experience flow when you're doing anything that you have a basic level of competence in and you enjoy. It could be gardening. It could be writing. It could be exercising, like, you know, most athletes experience. It could be anything that you do regularly and have good skill and experience with and are comfortable doing. Beyond that, it's really important to have the right sort of physiological state in order to experience flow. It's sort of the state of relaxed concentration where if you are too keyed up or too physiologically aroused, you're not going to be able to experience a state of flow. It will make you kind of anxious and you won't be able to have that relaxed concentration that's necessary to get into the zone. That's really important. There are a few other things too. The situation really needs to be under your control. So it's difficult to get into a state of flow if you're frequently being interrupted or need a lot of guidance or direction from other people. So it needs to be a pretty autonomous, self-involved activity.
So on a roller coaster, I'm not likely to achieve a state of flow.
Oh, no, that's an interesting question. Well, first of all, roller coaster is quite short. So I don't know that it would really give you the time and the conditions.
Sometimes I feel like my life is a roller coaster, which I guess is why
that's
that
a different
came to
case.
Mind.
That's a different story.
But, you know, I imagine there's some people listening who can identify with that. The things are unpredictable and you're going in and out. And as you say, people are coming into your life and interrupting when you're intending to get one thing done. All of a sudden, because some interruption or because your mind goes a different place, you realize you need to focus on getting something else done. And it seems to me that based on what you're describing, Brody, that those are exactly the opposite types of conditions from what would help somebody get into a state of flow.
Absolutely. So I'm an organizational psychologist by training, so I typically work in workplace settings. And the way that we work is terrible for encouraging people to get into a flow state. I'm sure there are people listening right now who have experienced flow at work, and that's when you become very productive and you produce great work and you enjoy what you're doing. And the day goes very quickly. But if you're constantly being interrupted by your BlackBerry or emails or instant messages or your coworkers, it prevents you from ever getting into that state of flow. So if you want to encourage people to get into a flow state at work where they're totally absorbed in whatever it is that they're doing, the best thing you can do is leave them alone.
So we can certainly use examples. For you who are listening, when was the last time you felt you were experiencing a period of peak performance like flow? What were you doing at the time? How'd that experience come about? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone if you're willing to help out with a story of your own. Or if you have questions about the topic, you can reach us at 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Industrial and research psychologist Brody Gregory is our guest. I interrupted your flow, Brody, when you were talking about some of the different types of conditions that can help people get into this particular state of peak performance. So I want to get back to that. If I forget, please remind me. But I also want to mention that flow is just one aspect of peak performance, and that's a much peak performance, the area that you study, is a much wider range of things. So tell us about that overall concept, if you would.
Sure. So I'm teaching a spring term course at Washington and Lee right now on peak performance. And the general idea behind peak performance is helping people to maximize their potential and strive toward being the best that they can be at whatever area that they choose to focus on. So that's really what my class is all about. And flow is just one of the many topics that we are discussing in this class.
What are some of the others? Goal setting, a big one?
Yes. Actually, we talked about goals today. So there's a great theory called control theory that kind of strings together goals and feedback, two things that really go hand in hand. We talked a lot in class today about how to set good goals, goals that are specific, that can be measured, that are time-bound in some way.
Got an example or two you can share?
Well, my students are focusing on a really wide array of things in their lives where they want to work toward peak performance. I've got a bunch of athletes, some people working on writing skills, some people working on more personal matters in their lives. One of my students, which I think is so cool, is focusing on being more present and engaged and mindful in his life. So he wants to be able to minimize distractions and be totally engaged in what's going on right now, whether it's a conversation with someone, whether it's the work that he's doing. And so we've talked a little bit about goals for his objective, because that's really quite intangible. So one of the challenges for my students is to figure out how they're going to quantify and measure performance. What is peak performance? Since it's so subjective, it's a challenging thing to develop criteria for.
It sounds like, Brody Gregory, that you're talking about dealing with people in their late teens and early 20s mm-hmm. who are in the process of learning about goals. I know that in your work in leadership development at Procter & Gamble, you had plenty of experience in helping people in a business setting focus on goals and develop leadership skills. So I wonder if maybe from that business setting, you can give some examples of what you're talking about the most efficacious ways of setting mm-hmm. goals, the sub-goals, the other structures that you were talking about.
Absolutely. So we all have goals, whether we are consciously aware of them or not. They drive pretty much everything that we do. You might have implicit goals that motivate your day-to-day behavior. People frequently set very sort of macro-level general goals. Like you could set a goal of, I want to lose weight, right? A lot of people talk about this goal these days. Honestly, that's a terrible goal. It is very general. It is not time-bound. It's not specific. There's no way to assess it. A much better way to write that goal would be, based on where I'm currently, maybe where I've been in the past, I would like to lose 5 pounds within the next 5 months. That's a much better goal. It's measurable. It's time-bound. It's realistic. It's very specific. What's even better is if you could then articulate specific ways that you're going to go about achieving that goal. So my goal is to lose 5 pounds in 5 months. So I'm going to change my diet by eating fewer processed foods, and then I'm going to exercise 4 days a week. So the lower level of specificity that you can get to when you're working toward a goal, the more likely it is that you'll actually be able to achieve that goal. So frequently, there's a big disconnect between these sort of abstract, grand goals that people set and the actual specific types of behavior that are required to make any progress toward that goal.
I just want to double check, Brody, that I understood what you said, that the lower level of specificity you can get to, the better?
Yeah, so it's a tricky terminology. And the reason I say lower level is if you think about goals as a hierarchy.
Okay.
So you want to go down to that very low level of a hierarchy with a lot of specificity.
So way down on the outline page.
Yeah, way down on the outline page.
That's why we call it lower.
So it's actually a high level of specificity, but it's a low-level goal hierarchy.
Dr. Jane B. Brody Gregory used to manage a global leadership development program at Procter & Gamble. Her primary field of interest is industrial psychology, although she has long studied crossovers between that field and social cognitive as well as positive psychology. Dr. Gregory is currently serving as a visiting professor at Washington and Lee University, currently teaching a course on peak performance, putting her research to use for her students. She's here to put it for use to us. And if you have a question for her, our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Let's get back to some of the specifics about this subset of peak performance called flow. Other than the things that you have mentioned already, any other examples of what somebody needs to enhance the probabilities?
Yeah, one specific thing that comes to mind is your mindset when you are engaging in some activity. So let's say you're an artist. Let's say you're a painter, and you want to get to a point where you can experience flow when creating art. One of the worst things that you can do is criticize yourself. That will ultimately prevent you from experiencing a flow state.
You heard the music.
I heard the music.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention artist, because there was an artist on our airwaves just a few days ago talking about something that I think fits within the description of what Brody Gregory has been telling us. So we're going to play a clip from that interview and ask some other questions about this psychological state that I suspect many of us would like to experience more of. But we got to pause for a 1 minute break. Specialist in the fields of leadership psychology and motivation, research psychologist Brody Gregory is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I owe our producers an apology. I was so fascinated with talking with Dr. Gregory during the break that I forgot to check with them and see if the audio is ready. Okay. Well, just this past Friday on our noontime program, The Spark, WMRA's Martha Woodruff interviewed an artist and school teacher from Louisa County. And we're going to play one brief clip from that interview where artist Janice Breeden talked about what often happens while she is alone by herself painting.
What's your level of engagement when you're painting? Does the rest of the world go away? Or
yes, oh, absolutely, yeah. When I paint, everything, time stops. I lose track of time. If I get really involved, sometimes I can spend a whole day painting and not even know I've spent the day. And only thing that tells me is my stomach starts growling.
So Dr. Gregory is what Janice Breeden was talking about on our program, The Spark, this past Friday. An obvious example of flow, or do you need to have something more than just losing time for it to be a flow experience?
No, I think that's a great example of flow. I think by losing a sense of time, she said she felt like time stopped, like the whole day passes. I think inherent in that is probably that she was so absorbed in what she was doing. I'm sure if we had her in here today and talked to her a little bit more, she would be able to elaborate on that. And
well, if there's any chance that Janice is listening, we'd love for her to call in.
Oh, she should call in. I'd love to talk to her about it.
And is painting the kind of experience where somebody who's not criticizing themselves,
yeah,
as you were talking about before the break, is really enjoying themselves and really focused, or maybe somebody playing an instrument, something that they just love to do, because of that affection for the process, that they're more likely to get into a state of flow?
Absolutely. You can experience flow in any number of activities. You just need to have a basic level of competence so that you're not worried about what you're doing. You need to really enjoy what you're doing so that you can kind of lose yourself in it. You need to move away from a self-focus. So your focus really needs to be on the task at hand. You need to be deeply engaged in it and concentrating on it. If you are worried about, I didn't do that brush stroke right, or, oh, I am doubting my competence as a painter, that's really going to prevent you from getting into a flow state. So yes, painting is a great example of where you could experience flow. Christine, the gardener, who wrote on Facebook earlier, experienced it with gardening, and she even said with writing. And I think that's another area in people's lives where they can experience flow. You have to obviously be pretty interested in and engaged in whatever it is that you're writing about. But if the words are just coming and you lose sense of time and of your surroundings, then that is a great example of being in a flow state.
Psychologist Brody Gregory, our guest on Virginia Insight. We got a couple of lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, but a couple of people have been holding on the other lines for a while, so let's get to them. Let's first go to Harrisonburg. Noel, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
I just had a couple of comments, actually. When you talk about the flow experience, I used to be, long ago, I was a dancer, and there was a woman many years ago who came up with a theory on the hierarchy of muscle tension as it relates to dancers, particularly when someone, say, who was a practiced and excellent ballet dancer was asked to do some form of tap dance. The hierarchy of muscle tensions were described as four different types. And as such, each of us has a kind of muscle activity that we are most comfortable with and or most uncomfortable with. She was developing this technique of moving from one state of muscle tension through the others so that a dancer who was particularly comfortable with one form of dance could become comfortable with the other forms of dance. The four kinds of movement were the arrestor, which is like marching, where the feet are very heavily planted into the ground. The assister, which is like modern dance, where there is much of a flow to a natural conclusion of movement. The arrestor, Oh, I'm sorry, not the arrestor, the perseverator, who is the tap dancer, the one where there's a rhythmic back and forth to the movement, such as when people are most comfortable when they are sitting and rocking or tapping a foot or drumming their fingers. And then finally, it's the ballet dancer, where there is the recognition that the positions between the movements are as important to the degree of relaxation as are the movements themselves.
Noel, this is so fascinating that I when we do a show on dance, we're obviously going to have you on, but I'm suspecting that we're getting close to where you want to connect this to the subject we've been discussing, peak performance and flow.
When I recognize this, I look at things like movies where, for example, in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the Robert Redford character is asked to show how well he can fire his pistol. And he tries to do it while standing still and can't hit the broadside of a barn. But then he asks if he's allowed to move. And when he moves, he is dead on with every single shot. And it's simply because the rhythm of his movement establishes him in space and allows the flow experience to occur.
What a fascinating concept. Dr. Gregory, do you think that movement is necessary to get into a state of flow?
You know, this is a really interesting perspective. And Noel, just listening to what you've been saying, I think from my perspective, what it boils down to is like you said, your comfort level with one specific type of action. And I don't think that for everyone, it would necessarily be the role of movement wouldn't necessarily be imperative. But I think it is performing under the circumstances or the conditions with which you are most comfortable. So you mentioned these four types of muscle tension for dance. If you are most comfortable with the arrestor, you'd probably be most inclined to experience flow there because you don't really have to think about what you're doing. But if you're very uncomfortable with the assister, for example, you're probably focused inwardly on what you're doing and thinking very carefully about how you place your feet and your arms. And when you're thinking at that level, you're not going to get into a flow state. It has to be sort of a full body engrossing experience. So with the Butch Cassidy example, it might not have been the critical role of movement. It might just have been that Butch Cassidy was more comfortable shooting his gun while he was moving. And so he's more effective when he's in those normal conditions that he usually experiences.
Noel, you raise fascinating points. Thank you again for your call. And Noel, having brought up this thing about movement, reminds me that there's a point on the flip side I wanted to make sure to ask you, Dr. Brody Gregory. I hear sometimes people talking about getting into deep states of meditation, mm-hmm. that what they report about the experience sounds real similar to what you've been describing as flow, but these are people that in order to get into these deep states have to stay absolutely still, both in body and in mind. Mm-hmm. Is deep meditation a type of flow?
You know, that's a really good question. And both flow and meditation fall under the umbrella of topics that are researched in the arena of positive psychology. Yes, I would suspect that you can experience flow when you are engaging in meditation, if it's something that you really enjoy and are comfortable with and experienced in. I think there are also a lot of other elements of meditation that go beyond flow. And just to be totally upfront, I am not that well versed in the psychology and the physiology behind meditation. There has been a lot of emerging research on the role of mindfulness meditation and using mindfulness meditation to sort of get people a little more centered and able to focus on the present and being more mindful in their lives. So I think there are definitely some links, but meditation goes above and beyond flow in its effects.
Visiting professor in the psychology department at Washington and Lee University, specialist in the fields of leadership psychology and motivation, Brody Gregory is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, talking about how to achieve peak performance and whether or not that's something that's a good idea to try for, including the subset of peak performance that psychologists call flow. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next to Timberville, Bill, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Brody Gregory, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an amateur painter and sculptor, and I find it's almost impossible to work without music in the background. And somehow music takes a part of my brain and gives it something to do that allows me to work without the influence of maybe the critical brain, or I don't know how to exactly say it, but it's part of my process of getting in the flow is to put on some old vinyl and listen to it and work from there, because it occupies a part of my brain that's distracting to the work at hand.
Yeah, Bill, I think that you are not alone in that experience. In fact, this makes me think about a really good friend of mine who is a very accomplished professional, does great work, very talented, but she gets very uncomfortable when she has to do any kind of public speaking engagement. And so she uses a technique to distract herself and prevent negative self-talk and worry and anxiety from setting in. She does math problems in her head. And I think it's basically the same mechanism as you listening to music when you are painting and sculpting. Sometimes distraction can be a very valuable way to keep ourselves from engaging in that negative self-talk. And as I mentioned earlier, being very critical of yourself or engaging in negative self-talk prevents you from entering a flow state. And if music is the best way that you can distract yourself and that helps you to get engrossed in your painting and sculpting, then that's fantastic.
Could you quantify the part of the brain that is doing the math while your friend is speaking? Is there any way to break that down?
You know, I'm sure there is, but I think we'd have to call my colleagues who are neuroscientists to help us out a little bit more with that.
Okay, well, that's another show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. We have something here from Doug on Facebook. I'm just going to read it. I don't have to understand it. Probably you will, Brody. Doug says, just like the flow of intersecting streams, waves, creating an interference pattern, is there a similar phenomenon in the performance flow that you speak about? And then he says, I should clarify, flow in this sense would be like conflicts of goal setting.
Well, it seems like there are two things going on with that question, Doug.
It seems to me like Doug is talking some about physics, so I get lost on that subject.
Well, he says waves, and I immediately go to brain waves.
Oh, okay.
And I, you know, full disclosure here, I am not a neuroscientist. We should call Tyler Lorig or Bob Stewart down at WNL to answer that part of the question. But I'm sure there are things going on at the physiological level in the brain when we experience flow that we would be able to observe and measure. The second part of the question sounded like competing goals. Is that correct?
Well, the first part, he talks about creating an interference pattern with intersecting waves and streams. And then the second part, he talks about conflicts of goal setting.
Conflicts of goal setting.
So I wonder if part of his question has to do with, because we talked about flow, and mm-hmm. then we talked about another area of peak performance that's related to goal setting.
Mm-hmm.
If you're setting a goal and being focused on the goal and overcoming some conflicts in whether in your mind or in your environment mm-hmm. in trying to focus on that goal, is it possible that that's going to keep you out of a state of flow?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, flow occurs when we are engaging in some kind of goal-directed behavior, whatever that might be. With Christine's example, it was gardening. Her goal was obviously to work on her garden. With Noel's example, his goal is to engage in some kind of dance activity, whether that is to complete a performance or practice some of his skills. With Bill's example, his goal is producing artwork. So I think the point here is that flow doesn't occur when you're just like randomly bumbling around in your life. You need to be engaged in some very specific task that allows you to become absorbed and is moving your behavior in some goal-directed fashion.
Are there any negative consequences of being in a state of flow or other peak performance states, or is it all positive?
No, I think that there are always downsides. And, you know, that's one of the hallmarks of positive psychology. People think that positive psychology is all about just trying to be happy all the time, when it's really not. It's about fully experiencing life and emotions in a genuine state. So with flow, you know, I mentioned earlier in the workplace, the best way to help people enter a state of flow is to leave them alone. However, that's not always realistic with the way that we work today. You know, you can't always shut yourself in a room for 5 hours and turn off your BlackBerry and focus on the work. You know, so often we work in teams and we work in groups and we have to be immediately responsive to changes in the work and in our environment.
Is flow almost always an individual experience? Is it just about impossible for a group of people to get into a flow situation together?
That's a great question. And we most often talk about flow as an individual experience. However, there is some emerging research on group and team experiences of flow. The conditions get a little bit more complicated because so much of flow is an internal mechanism. That it gets a little bit trickier with teams. And there hasn't been a ton of research here, but it is starting to emerge.
So back to this idea of whether it's ever a negative experience. I've heard people tell stories, Brody Gregory, of what sounded like being in flow or being mm-hmm. in the zone. An actor on stage, someone working in their garden, even colleagues doing interviews. And they say they were all completely losing track of time, really enjoying, really being in the experience. But when they came back down to earth, as one of them put it, they talked about feeling especially exhausted mm-hmm. or jittery or having really bad headaches. Does that mean that they were experiencing something other than flow, or that flow can be so intense that when you come back from it, there are negative consequences possible?
Yeah, I think that there can be negative consequences, and they probably just vary a great deal from person to person. I'm going to go back to Christine's example, the gardener. She said that she worked all the way through lunch. Next thing she knew, the school bus pulled up outside. Certainly, she would experience some physiological or mental consequences of that, of just being exhausted and depleted. I know I've personally experienced flow. When I was writing my dissertation, I would just write for hours. And next thing I know, I would look around and the room was dark because the sun had gone down and I hadn't eaten. And I just felt really out of it and kind of spacey afterward. And, you know, another complication of flow is that frequently when people experience it, they can't really tell you what happened. We see this with Michael Jordan. So Michael Jordan has frequently been cited as an athlete who experiences a flow state. There was one playoff game where he hit like 6 consecutive 3-point shots and kind of looked over at the sportscasters and shrugged his shoulders like he didn't really know what was going on either. There was the 1997 playoff game where he had the flu and just had an epic performance that night, but couldn't really tell you what happened. It was like he blacked out.
Is there hope that someday we may understand exactly what happened? So not that the rest of us would ever be Michael Jordan, but that we might achieve somewhat similar states in our chosen fields?
I think there are ways to get there.
And one of the reasons you work on this is having to do with trying to make our work mm-hmm. in different workplaces more effective. So I want to ask you about that, too, when we continue here on Virginia Insight. To you on the other side of your radio, if you're a parent, is the subject of goals or maximizing performance abilities or experiencing peak performance more often, are these things that you think it might be appropriate to discuss with children? At what ages? Is this a subject you'd like to see kids learning about in school? And at what level? Elementary, middle, high school? 888-WMRA-TALK is the phone number, 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. Dr. Jane B. Brody Gregory, used to manage a global leadership development program at Procter & Gamble. Her primary field of interest is industrial psychology, but she's long studied crossovers between that field and social cognitive, as well as positive psychology. Dr. Gregory, currently serving as a visiting professor in the psychology department at Washington and Lee University. From Free Union, Bert is calling in. Bert, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment, please.
To be succinct, why did you try to compare and contrast this with the meditation experiences? I recently read Csikszentmihalyi's book on flow, and he's been studying it for 20, 30 years, and I'm a chronic meditator, and I wanted to get a little bit of the input. Now, my own meditation practice is pretty intensive. And
Bert, when you come out of one of those deep meditations, do you have a sense that you've been in something like what Brody Gregory has been describing as a state of flow?
Exactly, but I don't come back fatigued. I come back energized.
And that's it, just to clarify from what I was saying earlier, Dr. Gregory, is that I have occasionally heard stories of people who've come back from a flow experience, experiencing something negative, but much like somebody who's gone out running and been on a runner's high, and at some point they injured their knee, and they didn't even realize it until they got done. But that's not necessarily, that's not the norm,
no.
Is it? It's a very small number of
well, the
examples,
answer,
probably.
The answer, like so many other things in psychology, is it depends.
Thank you.
So, Bert, you make a great point, and I'm so glad to hear that you read Csikszentmihalyi's book. So it's quite a mouthful. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is really the father of this whole concept of flow. And if it's something that our listeners are interested in learning more about, I strongly recommend reading the book. It's just called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. It's been around for a pretty long time, but it is a timeless read. It's very accessible if you're interested in psychology and in flow, and it can give you a lot of great ideas for how you can experience it. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi also has a TED Talk posted, if that's something that people are familiar with. So if you want to see him in action and hear him talking about flow, it's a great thing to check out.
Bert, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. Next to Winchester, Ed, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Dr. Brody Gregory, please.
Hello. I'm interested in finding out if there is a minimum time that it takes to get into the flow with various activities.
That is a great question, and yet another one that I would say it depends. It depends on what the task or activity is. It depends on your experience level with it. It probably depends on whether or not you've experienced flow before. So let's say you are a distance runner and you'd really like to experience a state of flow when you're running. If you've never experienced it before, it might take a while to kind of get into that state. But after a while, it might be a little bit more of an automatic process. So it depends on you as an individual, on your individual differences. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on your experience, your practice. So once again, the answer is it depends.
Are there particular experiences that you have, things that you've been doing, Ed, that have led to being in this sort of in the zone state?
Well, I'm a biologist, and I do a lot of biological research. And I find that it takes me an hour or more at the task once I get all the distractions out to really get into the flow. But then I kind of forget myself.
Well, I think that's a great example. And the way that you explained it makes perfect sense. So when you are engaging in a task, you have to kind of wade through all of the upfront stuff to get to the point where you can be fully engrossed and engaged in what you're doing. So you need to get past the distractions. You probably need to reacclimate yourself or get comfortable with the task at hand until you can settle back into that pattern. And I think that is typically how flow works in a workplace setting. If you are out running or painting or doing something that doesn't always have quite as much baggage, it can sometimes be a little bit easier. But again, depends a lot on the circumstances and on you individually.
Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is there something about routine that can lead to flow or inhibit flow?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one element of a task or of behavior that's really important is that you have a great deal of comfort with it, that it almost gets to the point of being an automatic behavior. And if routine is what gets you there, then certainly that can assist in you experiencing a flow state.
Julia in Stanton, thank you for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for psychologist Brody Gregory, please.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment about the group flow experience. I've been a professional dancer for many years now, and dancing with a large group of people for maybe a year or two, we really do start to begin to have this nonverbal flow, this kind of runner's high that people get. We experience it together. So we'll have a performance and afterwards just be in a state of awe, and everyone got to that point together. So, you know, years of dancing with people has led me to find that this group flow is totally possible.
Julia, that's a great comment, and it sounds like there are a few really important conditions to experiencing that state of group flow. First of all, everyone probably has a decent level of competence in what you're doing. Second of all, it sounds like you and probably others have experienced dancing in groups, which is important, so you're comfortable under those conditions. And third, I'm curious if it took a while for this particular group to be working together where you've developed that level of comfort and sort of being able to understand what your fellow group or team members are doing so that you can kind of function as a whole.
Absolutely. It took the first time that it ever really happened was in college, but the most intense time that it ever happened was in graduate school, which was a 3-year process for us to be together and mm-hmm. start to really understand how to work nonverbally as a group and to get to this high level of flow.
Great.
So, yeah, and it's time consuming.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to invest a lot of sort of team building. And I don't mean team building like let's go out and do a ropes course. I mean getting to know each other and understand how people function and how they respond. And I think that has great implications for things like sports teams as well. Those that can function as a whole and operate without speaking and know what their teammates are going to do tend to perform at a much higher level.
Julia, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Dr. Brody Gregory, I have a 2-part question here, so I want to start with the yes-no part.
Okay.
You already mentioned that there are certain negative emotions that are bound to inhibit mm-hmm. flow, and I think the one that you underscored was self-criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Would it also be true that other emotions like worry or guilt or anger or frustration are also going to inhibit?
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
So here's the second part, because I know that you work so much in the field of industrial psychology. Does this then offer some guidance for the workplace, especially for people who are trying to lead teams of other mm-hmm. people, managers, supervisors? There are theories in the workplace sometimes that you motivate people by cracking the whip, and other theories that you motivate people by letting them know that they are valued and sort of giving them their head.
Mm-hmm.
Does this imply that one theory or the other is more likely to induce peak performance abilities on the part of workers?
It's a really good question. My perspective on effective management is that it is very situation specific and tailored to the needs of the individual people who are working for you or work with you. That said, I'm a huge proponent of negative feedback. I think negative feedback is absolutely essential if people want to take their performance to a higher level.
I've actually heard you say before, Brody, that you like getting negative feedback.
Of course I do. It's the only thing that tells
me
what I need to improve.
So you're going
to
have to give me an example. Somebody okay. who was beating up on you when you liked it. Tell me about that.
Ah, but that's the thing. It's not beating up. It's constructive. So negative feedback, it's a really bad rap. People, when they think negative feedback, they think of things that are destructive and hurtful and tear them down. But effective negative feedback doesn't hurt people.
Well, tell me of a time that somebody did that to you and you liked it.
It happens all the time. I seek out negative feedback. And I think a great example is writing academic papers. So when you write an academic paper, you go through this extensive revision process, which is basically entrenched in negative feedback. So I send in an article to get it published in a journal. I get back pages and pages of constructive negative feedback. It doesn't tell me I'm a terrible writer. It doesn't tell me I don't know what I'm doing.
Can you think of something it did tell you that you could use as an example?
Absolutely. It says, your theory development on page 6 could be a little bit stronger. Why don't you try XYZ? That's good negative feedback. Tells you what you're doing wrong. Gives you direction to get better.
See, I would just think of that as constructive feedback.
Hey.
Why do you call it negative feedback?
Because it's negative in tone. It's telling you the distance between where you are and where you want to be. Positive feedback tells you that everything's okay. Negative feedback says there's something here that can be improved, but it doesn't have to be destructive or hurtful.
I guess negative is a term that can have so many different implications.
Oh, yeah. It gets a bad rap.
So when we're talking about encouraging peak performance,
mm-hmm.
and we know that people feeling frustrated, devalued,
mm-hmm.
Angry, guilty, self-critical
mm-hmm.
are all states of emotions that inhibit people getting to a state of peak performance.
Mm-hmm.
How can a manager use that awareness in order to do things differently,
mm-hmm.
in order to, whether they're giving constructive criticism or something else, to get their employees closer to a state of peak performance?
Well, I think the key when we're talking about feedback is what the focus of the feedback is on. Feedback should never focus on the person or a person's character or personality. It should focus on their behaviors or their tasks. So I would never say, Tom, you don't know what you're doing. I would say, Tom, when you host this show, it might not be a bad idea to, and I can't even think of some negative feedback to give you because I have such a good time when I come on here. But constructive feedback that is negative in tone should focus on a specific task or behavior and not on a person. Once it starts to focus on a person and their character or their abilities or their skills, that's when it becomes destructive, and that's when it leads to the negative self-talk.
The other thing that we've talked about in terms of achieving peak abilities and performance has to do with the value of setting goals.
Mm-hmm.
So before we close, I have to ask you about this because there are some who have criticized our society for being too goal-focused.
Mm-hmm.
Almost if America was, that our ethic is to be focused on the next project.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of always focusing on the future, losing out on the chance to be more fully experiencing the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that kind of concern?
I think that is a fundamental problem in and of itself. You know, I think, like I said earlier, we all have goals driving our behavior every day, whether we hold them implicitly or explicitly. Being unable to focus on and appreciate the present is a different kind of problem. I think it's important to have meaningful goals that drive our behavior in both the short term and the long term. However, problems can arise when you get into the intent or the spirit behind a goal. If a goal fosters greed or fosters treating other people poorly, then you have to ask yourself, is the intent of this goal good? Is this something that's going to make people's lives better? But there's no
reason.
Part
of my question was about mm-hmm. whether or not focusing on goals takes us away from being able to enjoy the present moment.
I think it does for some people, but...
But you feel it doesn't have to.
No, absolutely not.
And you think both of those things, being able to focus on goals and get them achieved,
mm-hmm.
and being able to stay and enjoy the moment here,
mm-hmm.
as well as prepare for the future, you think both of those are things that help people enjoy their life more?
I do. I think longer-term goals help us see greater purpose and meaning in our lives. You know, if we just, walked around life with blinders on and only focused on this very present moment, it would be challenging to see the bigger picture of life. However, there is tons of research showing how important mindfulness is and the ability to be fully present and engaged with what's going on in the moment. And I think this is kind of an art that people need to figure out for themselves, is how to balance all the multiple competing goals in their lives, short-term goals, long-term goals, personal goals, work goals, and still find a way to be present and engaged in their lives. It's definitely possible. It's not easy.
Only got about 30 seconds left.
Okay.
I saved this for last in case it's too embarrassing. We won't have to go on to it for too long. But one of your early experiences with being in the flow had to do with playing a computer game you weren't supposed to be playing.
That is true.
Close out with that story briefly, if you could, for me.
So it is a little embarrassing. I like to talk about flow with regard to running marathons and writing dissertations. But one of the most memorable flow experiences I had was when I was playing Tetris. I wasn't allowed to play video games when I was a kid, and I was just fascinated with Tetris.
And you were like, what, 13 or 14?
Oh, no, I was like 24, 25.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was in grad school. I probably should have been working on something more substantive.
So but this was also rebellion against all the time that your parents wouldn't let you play
the
game.
Yeah, I think it was. This is what happens, you know.
And what happened while you were playing Tetris?
The sun went down. 5 hours passed. My eyes felt like they were bleeding. I couldn't pull myself away.
But you thought you were in a state of flow.
It was amazing. It was.
Our guest has been research and industrial psychologist Dr. Brody Gregory, currently a visiting faculty member in the Department of Psychology at Washington and Lee University. Brody, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Likewise, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work Dr. Gregory is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.